by emphasizing the moral principles that we have in common. Organizations that are and are not explicitly religious can join forces in opposing that radically immoral project. I will close with the observation that insofar as Americans participate in this anti-imperial movement, their activities will be deeply patriotic because they will be seeking to call our nation back to its moral ideals, which stand diametrically opposed to the values implicit in the Global Domination Project. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
You're listening to Christian theologian and 9/11 researcher David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor, speaking on April 18th in Madison, Wisconsin. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. We continue as David Ray Griffin answered questions from the audience.
Okay, first one. These are pretty random, actually, because, as I said, they're all good. My 15-year-old daughter wanted to be here, but she's in a Spanish test tomorrow. Her question is, the U.S. military is running out of troops. A draft seems to be in the offing, but probably wouldn't be accepted by the people without another 9/11-type event. A WMD attack, perhaps. Do you see signs of this coming?
That's a very frightening thought coming from a 15-year-old, isn't it? Knows what's going on. Because the problem is, as she suggests, if a draft is started, then we do have Vietnam. And that's what they learned. If you have a draft, then you get movements on university campuses that get a lot of publicity, and they don't want that. So they've tried using high-tech technology, but boy, when you invade and occupy, you need a lot of troops, as they learned. So they tried mercenaries, but the mercenaries from the other countries are mostly going home now, so what are we going to do? So I'm afraid she's right that the thought of another new Pearl Harbor may be an option.
Perish the thought.
Perish the thought.
Okay, next, what is your opinion of Mike Rupert's work in Crossing the Rubicon, specifically about mock fake military exercises with live-fly hijacking exercises and radar inserts?
Yeah. Michael Rupert is one of the great heroes of the 9/11 movement. He was, he was there long before most everybody else was. Paul Thompson's great timeline that got me started, Paul gives Michael Rupert credit, says he got started with Michael. With regard to that particular thesis, it's one that I have not studied sufficiently to have what I would call a really informed opinion on it. It's certainly very interesting that these exercises were going on, but is exactly what role they played that morning, I'm just fairly agnostic. When it comes to Rupert's more particular thesis about Cheney being the one who was in charge that morning and calling the shots, that seems very clear. So we're clearly one on that, and I just say on the other, I think it's probably very significant, but I couldn't say anything more about it.
Okay. Next one, a common question that we conspiracy theorists hear. An inside job of this magnitude involves the conspiracy of a lot of people. How come there is no leak, nobody cracking, nothing? Thank you.
Yeah. Let me say a word about the term conspiracy theory. It's become almost an oath of being an American to say, oh, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. But Of course, your newspaper every day is filled with stories of conspiracies. Whenever two or more people get together to do something illegal or immoral, that's a conspiracy. And if you've got an idea of what happened, you have a conspiracy theory. So we all are believers in conspiracy theories. And the official story about 9/11 is the mother of all 9/11 conspiracy theories. This is the theory that these 19 Arab Muslim hijackers, without any help from anybody in the United States, out-tricked our trillion-dollar military defense system and pulled this off and knocked down these buildings. Well, the question is not whether you believe in a conspiracy theory or not, but which theory stands up to the evidence. Another thing to point out is that as James Fetzer, a philosopher of science, who is now getting involved in the 9/11 truth movement, has pointed out, theory is sometimes a very strong word. We have the theory of gravitation, you know, relativity theory. We have quantum theory. These are very precise theories. The point is they're testable. A conspiracy theory is fine if it's testable. Well, fortunately, the government's theory is testable. You can test. Can steel frame high-rise buildings fall down solely because of fire? And they've actually done experiments to try this, and they've never been able to get a building to even come close to collapsing. So it's a testable theory, which has been falsified. And I've indicated several other aspects that are, I think, clear falsifications of the official theory. Now, the question, all sorts of questions can be then raised, sort of a priori questions. Well, why would they do this? And I raised some of those in my book, if you read, chapter 9 of the New Pearl Harbor. There are lots of puzzling questions. I thought the first question was going to be, you know, what happened to Barbara Olson? And that's always the first one. I don't know. There are all of these things. And so is it possible that very many people could be involved in a conspiracy and keep it silent for a long time? Well, yes. Remember the Manhattan Project. A lot of people were involved in that, and that was kept secret for a long time. And we've looked back. Now we know that lots of previous conspiracies were kept silent for a long time. America's first attack in Indonesia, we had a full-scale war going on there. And until a book was published on it in the late 90s, hardly any Americans knew about it. It was kept secret for a very long time. If you add to the fact that we do have other instances, the fact that people, many of the people involved are government and military and other government employees who take an oath, like these FBI guys. They've taken an oath of obedience. If they violate that, see, they're hoping shippers could, I don't know what's happening now, but originally they were evidently hoping that shippers could get a trial so they could be subpoenaed, in which case they would have to testify, and that would free them from prosecution. But if they just come out and talk, then they're prosecuted, they're sent to prison for the rest of their lives maybe, they can't support their families. And then in some cases, people are told, well, you know, Joe, if you start talking about this, somebody's gonna get really mad at you, and I don't know how we're gonna protect your wife and kids. Would you talk? Particularly when there's no there's nobody asking you to come forward. Did the 9/11 Commission make a general appeal and say, please, if you've got any information on this, come and talk to us? No, nobody was invited other than government employees. And so if you go to the mainstream media, they ridicule you. So who's going to risk their family's life to come forward? So no, I am not surprised that a rather large number of people could be involved. And also, you know, we have previous examples of things that went on and people who knew got killed. How many in people who apparently had some knowledge about JFK's assassination ended up dead? A lot of people know about that, so they know what can happen. So no, I'm not surprised. But the fact is that, nevertheless, some people are trying to come forward. These FBI agents. Sybil Edmonds has been trying to come forward and tell her story for many, many months now. As I report in my book on the 9/11 Commission report, she testified to the commission for 3.5 hours. She told them very specific things. She's since then written a public letter to, an open letter to Chairman Kaine, reminding him of what she told the commission, such as that their Iranian asset had told them that Osama bin Laden, he was an expert on Afghanistan, that Osama bin Laden was planning an attack in the United States pretty soon. The translator who got that information was told to keep quiet within the FBI. She told the FBI about that. That other translator told the FBI in his 2.5 hours of testimony. None of that appears in the 9/11 Commission report. All that you learned that Sybil Edmonds, one tiny little note says that she had some suggestions that FBI should follow its own policies a little more closely. That's all you learned from her 3.5 hours of testimony. So she has been trying to come forward, and some other people too, and they've lost their jobs. So people are.
Okay, here's a question on source validation methodology. Who are your sources, and what standards did you employ to validate these sources?
Yeah. In the New Pearl Harbor, I did rely primarily on the four sources that I cited the most. Nafiz Ahmed's book, but he relied also a lot on Paul Thompson, and also used Michelle Chosdowski, the economist in Canada. Paul Thompson, one thing interesting about his timeline, and now he's published his book as The Terror Timeline, he used only mainline sources. So New York Times, Boston Globe, The Guardian, London Times, and so on. I don't even think he quoted The Nation. I mean, he really stuck to what are considered really mainline sources, and yet found hundreds of stories that contradicted the official account. As to method, you know, it's very partly you just have to learn to trust your kind of educated judgment. I've gotten into a lot of previous fields. My work at the Center for Process Studies called for me to organize conferences in a lot of fields, philosophy of physics, Eastern religions, Chinese religions, Asian, Hinduism, Buddhism, political theory, economic theory. So in each case, I had to go in and start reading around and learning who were the generally considered respectable writers, and then who were the ones who maybe weren't so respectable, but were good, and had something important to say outside the mainstream, and so on. So I think method is in that sense more of a sort of trained judgment about these things. And of course, people can differ on these things. But I did, and I limited myself to stories that I found to be at least highly plausible. But I did not commit myself, as those of you who have read the book, to say I know these stories are true. I mean, there are hundreds of stories there. And a single researcher like myself or Paul Thompson, we don't have the resources. So what we're calling on is we're saying there is a prima facie case here for a genuine investigation. We've got organizations that have the money to carry out investigations like that. They're called the U.S. Congress. They're called the U.S. media, which have billions of dollars. So the question is, what method are they using? Ignoring.
For what it's worth, David, I handed Senator Russ Feingold your book 2 weeks ago, and he promised to look into it.
I've had a lot of promises.
Yeah.
promises.
Okay,
but Russ Feingold is a good guy. I bet he'll do it.
Yeah.
I bet he'll do it.
Yeah. I actually urged him to take up this in hopes of a fine gold McKinney ticket next election, if there is an election. Okay, where do we go from here? How do we get through to a brainwashed electorate led by money and power?
Next question.
We invite C-SPAN.
Absolutely right. This is really a historic event. When the hearings were being were going on, C-SPAN covered those and covered some of the discussions that occurred afterwards with some of the 9/11 families. And Kyle Hintz of 9/11 Citizens Movement was able to make a statement which C-SPAN did cover, and so that did get conveyed to the American people. But to my knowledge, maybe C-SPAN can correct me, but to my knowledge, this is the first event in which this kind of major presentation, full hour presentation, has been made and covered. So this might be the beginning of something big. We'll see. Look about four more questions.
Okay, we've got room for four more questions at the top of the deck. Specifics. Isn't it true that CIA officials met with Osama bin Laden when he was being operated on in a hospital shortly before 9/11?
This seems to be true. It was reported by a very reputable Swiss journalist and picked up by several European newspapers, including some British newspapers, by just accidentally, I guess, by no American newspaper, but that in July of 2001, when Osama bin Laden was already the number one wanted man in the world, the report is that he went to a hospital in Dubai, the American hospital, was treated by an American surgeon and visited by the local CIA agent, as well as by the head of Saudi intelligence. So it appears that this is one of the many of the stories I tell in the New Pearl Harbor that suggests that the relationship between the Bush family and the bin Laden family isn't maybe exactly what we've been told. And of course, we have a full-length book on that, House of Bush, House of Saud. And in fact, let me say a word about that. That part of Michael Moore's movie, I'm blanking on the guy's name who wrote House of Bush, House of Saud.
Craig Unger,
yeah. I was very grateful. He corresponded with me on this. And if you remember, after the movie, when Michael Moore's movie got trashed so much by mainline critics, movie critics telling him he didn't know what he was talking about. They said that this idea that any Saudi flights were allowed to go before other flights were allowed to go was just false. And what Craig Unger had reported was that on the September 13th, 2 days after 9/11, there was a flight that took some young Saudis from Tampa to Lexington. And Lexington was one of the places where a big plane was going to take a number of them, bin Ladens and other Saudis, out of the country. And Craig Unger stressed that this flight left before private flights were allowed to go in the United States. Now, he emphasized that at 11 o'clock that morning, American airspace was open to commercial planes, but not to private. And there was a special notice sent out that says this is only for commercial flights. If any private flights go up, they will be forced down. Nevertheless, that flight went at 4:30 that afternoon and was not forced down. They had permission to go. Now, the 9/11 Commission poo-poos that story and says, oh, there was no problem because American airspace was opened at 11 o'clock, deliberately ignoring the distinction Craig Unger made very explicitly, both in his book and in a Wall Street Journal article, the distinction between commercial and private flights. So Michael Moore was right. Craig Unger was right on that.
Short of outright illegal disclosures, will it ever prove possible to create a culture of accountability and transparency with respect to the so-called intelligence community?
Well, many people believe that sort of the beginning of the end of the American Republic happened when the Intelligence Act was created there after World War II, and the CIA was created. Now, it did follow from a previous organization, the OSS, but still it had more powers, and these intelligence agencies now have enormous budgets. There are many of these intelligence agencies, so the CIA is just one of, 11 major intelligence agencies? So you have several, each military branch has to have its own. And so when you talk about what percentage of the American budget goes to military affairs, you know, even the official budget, the official amount is very high. But you really need to factor in a lot of money that is not usually considered military spending. So if you factored in just the budgets for the intelligence agencies, it was an enormous amount. I don't have the exact figure, and nobody does. It's a secret, but people who are in the know speculate that it is a very, very high figure. Well, when you have that kind of money with no accountability, you have, Lord Acton was certainly right. And, you know, he was a good Catholic. He was just carrying out what the Christians have called the doctrine of original sin, which is really the doctrine of originating sin. When he said, and it's very important to get the exact words correctly. It's usually misquoted. But he said, power tends to corrupt. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we have a military and a set of intelligence agency now that have virtually absolute power. Thank you very much for coming out on this one evening.
That was Professor David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor, speaking on April 18th at the Muslim, Jewish, and Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So, what can you do? Make copies of this talk and get it to people who have not heard anything but the official story. It's 1F by land, 2F by sea time, folks. You can download this program at our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. You can obtain video or audio as well as comprehensive 911 information at 911truth.org, www.911truth.org. For listeners here in New York State, there's something special that you can do. A complaint and petition have been filed with the office of the New York State Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, demanding a new investigation and prosecution of persons responsible for crimes committed on 9/11, including the murder of almost 3,000 people in New York City. Demand that Spitzer and other elected officials take action on the 911 complaint. To find out more, go to www.justicefor911.org, justicefor911.org. It should be clear that the people running things, both elected, allegedly elected, appointed, or pulling the strings from the so-called private sector, are monsters of corruption and greed who don't deserve your allegiance, obedience, respect, or cooperation. They don't deserve your money, your labor, or your blood. If you got what you just heard, you know that. Your task is to see that at least 80 million or so other Americans get it, too, and are ready to stop cooperating with business as usual. David Ray Griffin is a hard act to follow, but we'll be back with more after a breather.
Turn on the television. Open up a magazine. Hear the broadcast of the massacre. Read about some tragedy. See the man with the pretty face. Summarize the daily news. Turn the pages, hear the whispering. All the voices telling you everything's fine. Everything is okay. Don't you worry about a thing now. All our problems go away. Everybody close your eyes. Everyone look the other way. Everything is just dandy. There's no trouble. Just the other day, another black man was shot dead. 20 bullets from the barrels of a police gun shot him in the back while he fled. The people rose up, they took to the streets to defy these racist pigs. They met them with batons and their tear gas guns. The next day the police chief said, everything's fine. Everything is okay. Don't you worry about a thing now. Thank you. everything is okay. Don't you worry about a thing now. All our problems go away. Everybody close your eyes. Everyone look the other way. Everything is just dandy. There's no trouble here today. You go to work in the morning. You do this each and every day. Making profit for the company while they take your life away. Tell me why it's gotta be that we do not own our own lives. Tell me when we're gonna refuse to believe these fucking lies. Everything is not fine. Everything is not okay. Wake up, America, it's found you. The pain will not go away. Don't you dare close your eyes. Don't you look the other way. This time your flag will not protect you. No matter how much you bomb or pray. Don't you dare close your eyes. Don't you look the other way. While they build these walls around you, may your sleep wake you under rage. Yes, they build.
Next, I'd like to read you an article that was published on May 4th at the website tompaine.com. The author of the article is Ray McGovern, a former CIA intelligence analyst, now one of the founders of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. The title of McGovern's piece is Proof Bush Fixed the Facts. Intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy, quote unquote. Never in our wildest dreams did we think we would see those words in black and white, and beneath a secret stamp, no less. For 3 years now, we in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, have been saying that the CIA and its British counterpart, MI6, were ordered by their country's leaders to, quote, fix facts to, quote, justify an unprovoked war on Iraq. More often than not, we have been greeted with stares of incredulity. It has been a hard learning that folks tend to believe what they want to believe. As long as our evidence, however abundant and persuasive, remained circumstantial, it could not compel belief. It simply is much easier on the psyche to assent to the White House spin machine blaming the Iraq fiasco on bad intelligence than to entertain the notion that we were sold a bill of goods. Well, you can forget circumstantial. Thanks to an unauthorized disclosure by a courageous whistleblower, the evidence now leaps from official documents. This time, authentic, not forged. Whether prompted by the open appeal of the International Truth-Telling Coalition or not, Some brave soul has made the most explosive patriotic leak of the war by giving London Sunday Times the official minutes of a briefing by Richard Dearlove, then head of Britain's CIA equivalent, MI6. Freshly back in London from consultations in Washington, Dearlove briefed Prime Minister Blair and his top national security officials on July 23, 2002, on the Bush administration's plans to make war on Iraq. Blair does not dispute the authenticity of the document, which immortalizes a discussion that is chillingly amoral. Apparently, no one felt free to ask the obvious questions, or worse still, the obvious questions did not occur. In emotionless English, Dearlove tells Blair and the others that President Bush has decided to remove Saddam Hussein by launching a war that is to be, quote, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, close quote. What about the intelligence, Dearlove adds matter-of-factly? The intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy, close quote. At this point, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw confirms that Bush has decided on war, but notes that stitching together a justification would be a challenge since, quote, the case was thin, close quote. Straw noted that Saddam was not threatening his neighbors and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. In the following months, the case would be buttressed by a well-honed U.S.-UK intelligence-turned-propaganda machine. The argument would be made, quote, solid enough to win endorsement from Congress and Parliament by conjuring up aluminum artillery tubes misdiagnosed as nuclear-related, forgeries alleging Iraqi attempts to obtain uranium in Africa, tall tales from a drunken defector about mobile biological weapons laboratories, bogus warnings that Iraqi forces could fire WMD-tipped missiles within 45 minutes of an order to do so, dodgy dossiers fabricated in London, and a U.S. national intelligence estimate thrown in for good measure. All this, Dearlove notes dryly, despite the fact that, quote, there was little discussion in Washington of the aftermath after military action, close quote. Another nugget from Dearlove's briefing in his bloodless comment that one of the U.S. military options under discussion involved a, quote, continuous air campaign, close quote, initiated by an Iraqi casus belli, the clear implication being that planners of the air campaign would also see to it that an appropriate casus belli was orchestrated. The discussion at 10 Downing Street on July 22, 2002 calls to mind the first meeting of George W. Bush's National Security Council, NSC, on January 30, 2001, at which the president made it clear that toppling Saddam Hussein sat atop his to-do list, according to his then Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, who was there. O'Neill was taken aback that there was no discussion of why it was necessary to take out Saddam. Rather, after CIA Director George Tenet showed a grainy photo of a building in Iraq that he said might be involved in producing chemical or biological agents, the discussion proceeded immediately to which Iraqi targets might be best to bomb. Again, neither O'Neill nor the other participants asked the obvious questions. Another NSC meeting 2 days later included planning for dividing up Iraq's oil wealth. As for the briefing of Blair, the minutes provide further grist for those who describe the UK Prime Minister as Bush's poodle. The tone of the conversation bespeaks a foregone conclusion that Blair will wag his tail cheerfully and obey the learned commands. At one point, he ventures the thought that, quote, if political context were right, people would support regime change, close quote. This after Attorney General Peter Goldsmith has already warned that the desire for regime change was not a legal base for military action. a point Goldsmith made again just 12 days before the attack on Iraq, until he was persuaded by a phalanx of Bush administration lawyers to change his mind 10 days later. The meeting concludes with a directive to, quote, work on the assumption that the UK would take part in any military action, close quote. I cannot quite fathom why I find the account of this meeting so jarring. Surely it is what one might expect, given all else we know. Yet seeing it in bloodless black and white somehow gives it more impact. And the implications are no less jarring. One of Dearlove's primary interlocutors in Washington was his American counterpart, CIA Director George Tenet. And there is no closer relationship between two intelligence services than the privileged one between the CIA and MI6. Tenet, of course, knew at least as much as Dearlove, but nonetheless played the role of accomplice in serving up to Bush the kind of slam-dunk intelligence that he knew would be welcome. If there's one unpardonable sin in intelligence work, it is that kind of politicization. But Tenet decided to be a team player and set the tone. Actually, politicization is far too mild a word for what happened. Intelligence was not simply mistaken, it was manufactured, with the President of the United States awarding Foreman George Tenet the Medal of Freedom for his role in helping supervise the deceit. The British documents make clear that this was not a mere case of leaning forward in analyzing the intelligence, but rather mass deception, an order of magnitude more serious. No other conclusion is now possible. Small wonder, then, to learn from CIA insiders like former case officer Lindsay Moran that Tenet's malleable managers told their minions, "Let's face it, the president wants us to go to war, and our job is to give him a reason to do it," close quote. Small wonder that, when the only U.S. analyst who met with the alcoholic Iraqi defector appropriately named Curveball raised strong doubt about Curveball's reliability, before then Secretary of State Colin Powell used the fabrication around mobile biological weapons trailers before the United Nations, the analyst got this email reply from his CIA supervisor, quote, "Let's keep in mind the fact that this war is going to happen regardless of what Curveball said or didn't say, and the powers that be probably aren't terribly interested in whether Curveball knows what he's talking about," close quote. When Tenet's successor Porter Goss took over as director late last year, he immediately wrote a memo to all employees explaining the rules of the road. First and foremost, quote, "We support the administration and its policies," close quote. So much for objective intelligence insulated from policy pressure. Tenet and Goss, creatures of the intensely politicized environment of Congress, brought with them a radically new ethos, one much more akin to that of Blair's courtiers than to that of earlier CIA directors who had the courage to speak truth to power. Seldom does one have documentary evidence that intelligence chiefs chose to cooperate in both fabricating and sexing up, as the British press puts it, intelligence to justify a prior decision for war. There is no word to describe the reaction of honest intelligence professionals to the corruption of our profession on a matter of such consequence. Outrage does not come close. Those of us who care about unprovoked wars owe the patriot who gave this latest British government document to the Sunday Times a debt of gratitude. Unauthorized disclosures are gathering steam. They need to increase quickly on this side of the Atlantic as well, the more so inasmuch as Congress controlled by the President's party cannot be counted on to discharge its constitutional prerogative of oversight. In its formal appeal of September 9, 2004, to current U.S. government officials, The Truth-Telling Coalition said this, quote, "We know how misplaced loyalty to bosses, agencies, and careers can obscure the higher allegiance all government officials owe the Constitution, the sovereign public, and the young men and women put in harm's way. We urge you to act on those higher loyalties. Truth-telling is a patriotic and effective way to serve the nation. The time for speaking out is now." Close quote. If persons with access to wrongly concealed facts and analysis bring them to light, the chances become less that a president could launch another unprovoked war against, say, Iran. And I was reading from an article, "Proof Bush Fixed the Facts," written by Ray McGovern, who served 27 years as a CIA analyst and is now on the steering group of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
The president came to London, was greeted by the queen, for the people of the city, it was a festive scene. Hundreds of thousands of women and men were all in the street, shouting and dancing and talking and marching on their feet. But the highest peak of the evening, to be only fair, was when the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square. Those days in London was the place to be. Young and old, black and white, was the face of society. Even the mayor came out, called him a criminal of war, said world domination ain't worth fighting for. They said, "We don't like W or his poodle, Tony Blair." On the day the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square, the night sky was lit up, and the message, it was clear. We do not want fascism over there or over here. It was heard firsthand by many right there, British soil. We will not fight for Exxon, we won't kill or die for oil, but for billions around the planet, we were all right there. When the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square, when the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square.
So, while the murderous, greedy monsters covered in blood are clinking their glasses in Washington, D.C., or barbecuing ribs in Crawford, Texas, four of the finest people in our community are facing a second trial for an act of resistance aimed at stopping the illegal, contrived blood for oil invasion of Iraq. And they have just learned that the judge intends to deny them the legal means to defend themselves effectively. Teresa Grady, Peter DeMott, Claire Grady, and Daniel Burns of Ithaca are now facing a trial in federal court after their first trial in Tompkins County Court last year ended in a hung jury 9-3 in favor of their acquittal. Tompkins County District Attorney George Dentes persuaded the feds to take up the case. In mid-April, the four filed a series of pretrial motions. Included in the motion was their request to conduct their own voir dire of the jury, a motion to dismiss the case, a motion to continue the trial, which means postpone it, and a request for copies of communications between the state and federal officials regarding the decision to prosecute them a second time. In addition, they filed a second motion regarding introduction of evidence related to international law. The motion to continue the trial was granted, and the trial date was set for September 19th. All the other motions were denied. The upshot of this ruling is that they are being denied the chance to defend themselves. Daniel Burns said, "If we're not able to talk about the legal and moral motivations for our actions, how can we defend ourselves?" The charges they're facing, which carry a maximum 6-year sentence in federal prison, stem from an action at the Military Recruiting Center in Lansing, New York, where they carefully poured their own blood in the vestibule of the station, then remained to pray for an end to war. This took place on March 17, 2003, hours before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. This action was part of a worldwide pledge of resistance that joined thousands of others committing civil disobedience in an effort to stop the invasion. Teresa Grady, one of the other defendants, said, "Judge McEvoy has ruled that even if the United States is in violation of international law, and even if we acted to prevent these violations, our motive for acting is irrelevant. In clear violation of the Nuremberg Principles and the Constitution, he has ruled that domestic law supersedes international law. I encourage the judge to remember that everything that Hitler did was illegal under domestic law. Likewise, efforts by conscientious Germans to resist Hitler were illegal under domestic law." Further judicial impropriety may be inferred from the fact that the trial is located in Binghamton at all. Given that all of the defendants reside in Ithaca, they could have been tried, if they had to be tried, in federal court in Syracuse, where the jury pool would have included, once again, people from Tompkins County. The setting of the trial in Binghamton presumably was intended to screen any sympathetic community members from the jury pool. Ironically, however, one of the defendants, Daniel Burns, was born and raised in Binghamton, where his large family is quite well known, his father, recently deceased, having once served as Binghamton's mayor. I'd like to close the program by a commentary that appeared in the Binghamton Press and Sun Bulletin regarding the case by Associate Editor David Rossi. It's titled, "What Will They Say 30 Years From Now?" War comes home in a number of ways. We see it in the joyous return of veterans whose lives have been spared, and in the funerals of those who were less fortunate. We see it in the Memorial Day and Veterans Day parades, and we see it in our friends and loved ones who forever bear the scars, some visible, some unseen, but no less real, that war leaves. And sometimes war causes casualties without ever leaving home. This is what has happened to four people whose friends and supporters have dubbed them the St. Patrick's Day Four because their protest was staged March 17, 2003, St. Patrick's Day. The four were among a group of about 20 anti-war activists who gathered outside a military recruiting office at the Cayuga Mall in Lansing near Ithaca, days before the Bush administration launched its invasion of Iraq. The four, Claire Grady, Daniel Burns, Teresa Grady, and Peter DeMott, then entered the office where they sprinkled a small amount of blood, which they said was their own, and were consequently arrested. They were charged with third-degree criminal mischief, but not convicted. Their trial in Tompkins County ended in a mistrial when the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The county district attorney then dropped the charges, but for reasons best known to himself, persuaded a U.S. attorney to charge the four under federal statutes. Now the four face a September trial in U.S. District Court in Binghamton. The charges? Injury and damage to government property, entering a military station for unlawful purposes, then re-entering the property after being removed, If convicted, they could face prison time and fines. The federal judge should toss the case after opening arguments. The defendants have said they acted out of conscience in opposition to an unjust and illegal war. And it would be unfair, it says here, to doubt their motives. They certainly had nothing to gain from what they did. Defenders of our misadventure in Iraq bridle at comparisons with Vietnam, but they are becoming impossible to ignore. Civilian protest is but one example. Homefront protests against our involvement in Vietnam were far more explosive and widespread, and they helped bring that sorry episode in our history to an end. That may not happen this time, given Americans' sheep-like acceptance of this administration's lies and deceptions that led us to the war and the lies and deceptions that continue. So acts of protest, such as that staged by the St. Patrick's Four, while understandable, probably will prove unproductive. A government that condones torture and lies about the human toll that has resulted from its actions is not going to be swayed by public opinion. Last Saturday, on the 30th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, NPR's Scott Simon interviewed Holly Watts, a Red Cross volunteer and author of a book, Who Knew? Reflections on Vietnam, based on her experiences during the war there. It was a poignant interview, and at the end, Simon asked Watts if she thought the loss of all those men and women whose names appear on the memorial in Washington and the deaths of countless Vietnamese was worth it. After a long pause, Watts replied, almost in a whisper, "No." The guess here is that 30 years from now, someone will ask another author if the blood sacrifice of Americans and Iraqis was worth it. I won't be here to hear it, but I think I know what the answer will be. That commentary from David Rossi, associate editor of the Press and Sun Bulletin of Binghamton, New York. There will be a benefit to raise money for the defense of the St. Patrick's Day Four, held on May 22nd in Binghamton. Internationally acclaimed Irish vocalist Karen Casey will be headlining the bill. Also performing are noted local musicians, the Byrne Sisters, who are, you got that right, sisters of defendant Danny Burns. This will take place at the Phelan Center, which is at St. Catherine of Siena Church, 1051 Chenango Street in Binghamton. Tickets are available at Sunrise Health Foods at 200 Main Street in Binghamton and at Small World Music at 614 West State Street in Ithaca. All the proceeds go to the St. Patrick's Day Four Defense Fund and to local efforts to bring an end to war. Tickets are $15, but you can call for family rates at area code 607-256-0428. Obviously, this is only relevant to our Central New York listeners. However, the St. Patrick's Day defendants appreciate support from wherever it comes. You can contact them by calling Daniel Burns at area code 607-280-0369. 607-280-0369. If you'd like to download a copy of tonight's program or contact us, visit our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org, where I will also post links to more information about 9/11 truth. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Like an old